Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hej och varmt välkomna till ett nytt avsnitt av Sinnessjukt med mig, den djupt osympatiske Christian Dahlström. Jag hoppas att ni mår bra. Själv är jag inne i en ångestperiod, om jag ska vara ärlig. Jag vet inte om det beror på att jag ju testat att sluta med antidepp eller om det bara är sakernas tillstånd med kriget och galopperande bolåneräntor och annalkande vinter eller någonting annat. En sak som i varje fall gjorde mig väldigt glad var att så många av er kom till Mental Health Run i år. Det verkar ha blivit nytt rekord i år igen och mer pengar då till psykiatriforskningen, vilket gör att man trots allt känner hopp om livet igen. Okej, idag ska ni i varje fall få den andra delen av min intervju med professor Cynthia Bulick, som alltså är en av världens främsta experter på ätstörningar. Idag fortsätter vi att prata om anorexia, där vi bland annat pratar om en fråga som jag diskuterade på Twitter med en forskare som heter Per Köhler för något år sedan. Han skrev då att dödligheten ofta överdrivs och att inläggningskrävande anorexia har en mortalitet kring 1% för alla åldersgrupper. Enligt Cynthia är det här optimistiskt, som ni kommer att få höra. Sen pratar vi i varje fall om bulimi, där vi pratar om både grundsymptomen och symptomen bortom diagnoskriterierna. Cynthia berättar vad som skiljer bulimi från anorexia med hetsätning samt hur allvarligt bulimi kan bli. Vi pratar även om det som är den vanligaste ätstörningen av alla, vilket jag inte kände till innan jag läste Cynthias fantastiska bok, nämligen hetsätningsstörning, som ju heter Binge Eating Disorder, eller BED på engelska, så ni hänger med. Recensionen av Cynthias bok finns för övrigt i avsnittsbeskrivningen även idag. Angående hetsätningsstörning får vi veta mer om den diagnosen. Vi pratar bland annat om kopplingen mellan hetsätningsstörning och bantning, om hur svårt det är att motstå impulsen att hetsäta och vilken skam man ofta känner efteråt. Efter de här tre diagnoserna pratar vi mer generellt om ätstörningar. Jag frågar huruvida ätstörningsforskningen ligger efter annan psykiatriforskning och ifall det är så att Cynthias genetikforskning har fått henne att ändra uppfattning om hur skadlig reklamen är för vår kroppsuppfattning. Sen avslutar vi med en expertfråga från forskaren och överläkaren och författaren för övrigt, Lotta Borg Skoglund, som undrar om kopplingen mellan neuropsykiatriska funktionsnedsättningar och ätstörningar. Väldigt spännande fråga. Innan vi drar igång vill jag förresten berätta att jag ska till Höganäs nu på torsdag och prata om depression och ångest på stadshuset där klockan 15.00. Det här evenemanget kommer även att livesändas på YouTube och man kan ställa frågor anonymt till mig efteråt om man undrar något. Är man där på plats kommer man även att kunna köpa signerade ex av mina böcker och så vidare. Länk till evenemanget i avsnittsbeskrivningen. Men med det sagt så har det blivit dags att återvända till det där konferensrummet på Karolinska institutet här i Stockholm, där vi återigen ska träffa professor Cynthia Bulick från den 8 september i år. Och vi fortsätter där vi slutade, nämligen i diskussionen om kroppsuppfattning hos personer med anorexia. Varsågoda. This awareness of how thin you are, can it also kind of come and go?
Yeah, that's I have seen people who have had severe and enduring anorexia nervosa, so maybe they've had the illness for 10, 20 years, where their perception of their body becomes more realistic as they've had the disorder longer. They'll say, I look in the mirror and I know I look like a skeleton, but I still can't eat. They still can't bring themselves to eat.
Okay, but is that the most common path or whatever, that you, as when you had it for longer, you tend to see how thin you are, or is it?
Yeah, no, I don't think there are actually any data that would say, you know, whether that's true or not, but I have seen it in some cases.
Okay, all right. I've heard that anorexia is the mental illness with the highest mortality rate of all, even as high as 10%, but I recently talked about this with a Swedish researcher who said that this claim is based on old studies of untreated anorexia. He said that the mortality rate is actually around 1% or even lower in countries like Sweden, where you get treatment, and there's also even involuntary treatment is allowed, which it isn't in many countries. Is that right, or how high is the mortality rate, would you say?
I wish that Swedish researcher's answer were true. Unfortunately, that's an underestimate. And unfortunately also, we don't always have good data on what the cause of death is. So anorexia has the second highest mortality rate at this point, and I think it has been surpassed by opiate dependence.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, some of the substance use disorders have, you know, especially when drugs are laced with fentanyl or some other thing.
Yeah.
So that mortality has just skyrocketed in that. So anorexia gets below that. And, you know, there has been one study that was done a long time ago that said it was about 5% per decade. And then you see numbers that go from 1% to 20%, but I think it's safe to take all of the epidemiological data together and say somewhere between 5 and 10%.
Okay, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
There should be zero.
Yeah. And what do they die from? Is it suicide, or is it the body collapsing?
Yep.
Or?
It is both of those things.
Okay.
So the two primary causes of death are, you know, when you have the illness, basically every organ gets affected. So your organs just start shutting down. But then suicide is the second highest cause. And it's interesting because for many parents, especially with this history of blaming anorexia on parenting, they've got so much shame associated with their children having an eating disorder. But then having a child suicide carries its own stigma.
Yeah.
So it's almost like they've got this double stigma and double shame. I've had so many parents that have come to me years after their child died and said, we never told anybody this before, but she didn't just die. She actually did kill herself.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I think talking about that and having other parents talk about it is really helpful and comforting.
Yeah. We'll talk more about anorexia a little later when we talk about treatments, but let's talk a little bit about bulimia first. Can you tell me what the core symptoms of bulimia are, really short?
Sure. So bulimia is marked by two behaviors: binge eating, like I talked about before, eating an unusually large amount of food in a short period of time, and feeling out of control while you're doing it. There's like no number of calories that call it a binge. It really is that out of control feeling that we're looking for. And in bulimia, that is coupled with compensatory behaviors, which can be any type of purging behaviors, self-induced vomiting, laxative abuse, exercise, fasting, for example.
Yeah. But as you mentioned earlier, there's also a binge eating purging subtype diagnosis of anorexia. What's the difference between that diagnosis and bulimia?
So if someone has anorexia nervosa, so they're underweight, they meet criteria for anorexia nervosa, and they're binge eating and purging, then they get anorexia binge purge subtype. If they don't have anorexia nervosa, then they go into the bulimia category. It's like anorexia trumps all.
Okay. As with anorexia, you write that individuals with bulimia also often suffer from depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, and so on. Can you tell us a little bit about the symptoms associated with bulimia beyond the diagnostic criteria?
Yeah. So as with anorexia nervosa, we see high rates of anxiety disorders, high rates of depression. And unlike anorexia, we see more substance use disorders in people with bulimia nervosa. So the comorbidity or the illnesses that co-occur with it are overlapping on the depression and anxiety side, but are a little different on the substance use side, with more being seen in bulimia nervosa.
Yeah. I think you also mentioned like impulse control problems, impaired concentration and memory and so on. Is that also
right? And so that can happen with more severe bulimia. And what we're talking about, I mean, the impulse control disorder sort of pull that all together, right? It's a disorder of impulse control. Anorexia is almost like over control, and bulimia is intermittent loss of control.
Okay. You write that the media loves anything with a provoking visual hook, which is why they more often write about anorexia than other eating disorders. But like anorexia, bulimia can be a devastating disorder. Can you tell us just a little bit about the degrees of severity on and bulimia?
Sure. And you're right. The glamorization of anorexia nervosa, I think, is really quite dangerous. And it can give people ideas, and it can put people down a path of engaging in behaviors that can lead to anorexia nervosa. Like extreme dieting is a risk factor for developing the illness. And, you know, the last thing we want people to do is look at a magazine cover, go on a diet, and then, you know, really open the door to developing anorexia. Now, in terms of bulimia, back to your question, the severity of bulimia nervosa. So one of the things that can be deadly is purging. Laxative abuse, vomiting can lead to disturbances in your electrolyte levels. And of course, in order for our hearts to work, for the rest of our organs to work, we have to have our electrolyte levels, sodium, potassium, calcium, in balance. And that is one of the number one reasons why people with bulimia are at risk for cardiac arrest. And that's one of the things that is really horrible to see when that happens secondary to bulimia. Also, a lot of gastrointestinal problems with people with bulimia. And I mean, all the way from ruptures of the esophagus and the stomach to one of the things that we're very interested in is long-term risk of oral cancers in bulimia nervosa. Because if someone is vomiting a lot, they constantly have acid in their esophagus and in their mouth. And we know that it erodes the teeth. So dentists can often tell if someone has bulimia. And we work with them all the time in terms of them being able to help a patient seek treatment. Since they do have often the first window into the behavior. So, you know, really we're talking about all the healthcare professionals that can detect and refer eating disorders.
Yeah.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
This might be a stupid question, but do some patients go back and forth between anorexia and bulimia or binge eating disorder?
That is not a stupid question.
Oh,
that is a very accurate perception of what happens. In fact, we have this wonderful image of bubbles in three different points in time, and it's using the Swedish quality registers for eating disorders. And we look at how the diagnoses change over time. And you can see lines going from one to another across the different bubbles. About 50% of anorexia, people with anorexia will transition to bulimia during the course of their illness. There's a lot of back and forth between binge eating disorder and bulimia. You know, so these disorders are both, they're not mutually exclusive.
No.
Although some people do maintain one symptom profile throughout the course of their illness.
Okay.
Yep.
And talking about binge eating disorders, BED seems to be the most common eating disorder, afflicting about 3.5% of women and 2% of men in the United States. But before DSM-5, this was not even a diagnosis. How is that possible?
Yeah, so it's... It was there. It's been around. It's been talked about since the 1950s.
Okay.
And it was probably there long before that.
Yeah.
But it takes a while for a disorder to become official in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And that's what we were waiting for. But, you know, the difference between binge eating disorder and bulimia is in binge eating disorder, you have those binges, but in the absence of the compensatory behaviors. So in the absence of purging. So what that also means is that people with binge eating disorder tend to be larger bodied individuals. Not always.
Okay.
Binge eating disorder can happen if you're normal weight, large, you know, large body. But the big distinguishing factor is the presence or absence of purging behaviors.
Yeah. You're right that many argue that BED is as much a dieting disorder as it is a binge eating disorder. In what sense?
Yeah. So when you go back in time and ask people, what was your first symptom? What was the first disordered behavior that you remember? There's a percentage of people with binge eating disorder who say that they have been ravenous eaters since they were babies.
Okay.
You know, so really, they were binging from early on.
Yeah.
But other people say that dieting has always preceded their binge eating. And the way we think about that is some people will go on a diet and they'll be like, okay, we're done with this. And they'll just go on normally and they'll go back to their normal eating and there will be no change. Other people will go on a diet and that can be the trigger for two different things. On one hand, that diet, if you're genetically predisposed to anorexia nervosa, might open that door toward further restriction and for ongoing restriction. But if you're more genetically prone to binge eating disorder or bulimia, it's that diet that might trigger your body to go in the opposite direction.
Okay.
And that's when your body's like, you know, after a period of restriction, you just get ravenous and you make up for it. And then you overshoot your satiety level.
Okay. So there's like cycles going back
and
forth.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just to take a step back to the last question about why the BED hasn't become a diagnosis until very late. The whole field of research in eating disorders is pretty young, right?
Not
young, but relative to other
we're behind. Areas. I think the way of saying it is we're behind. And we've gone down a couple blind alleys. And I think for the longest time, there has been so much research about body image and so much research about the impact of the media on dieting and so much stuff about families and causes. We really missed the boat when it came to figuring out what causes these illnesses. Like when you look at the genetic research that we're doing here in Sweden, we're a good probably 10 to 13 years behind the other major psychiatric disorders like depression and schizophrenia when it comes to really teasing out what the genetic factors are that increase risk.
Yeah, that was actually one of my later questions, but I'll have it now because in your book, it's 10 years old. So you focus a lot of on how big industry affects our body image and so on. But in a more recent interview, you said that we may have overestimated those effects, at least as a cause of anorexia, if I understood you correctly. Has your research on genetics kind of influenced your view on anorexia and other eating disorders in that sense?
Insofar as we should not let environment off the hook. And I think that's the really important message. It's like, yes, genetics play a role. And yes, we're starting to really home in on the genes that increase risk.
Yeah.
But It's all those environmental insults that lead people to engage in the behaviors that start them down the path of developing the eating disorder. So if we were more accepting of a wider variety of body shapes and sizes, people wouldn't have to go on a diet in the first place. And if big food and beverage weren't trying so hard to get us addicted to their foods so that they can make more money, then we would be less likely to actually find foods that were binge foods. So I'm not going to let them off the hook all. I'm just looking at how both genes and environment act and co-act to influence risk for eating disorder.
Okay. Going back to BED, one of your patients described it like this. I remember with shame having eaten my son's entire birthday cake, all decked out in a legal theme, before he and his friends got home from school for the party. I had to run to the store and buy a generic undecorated sheet cake just so they would have cake. I have never felt so ashamed. When the urges would come over me, nothing, not even disappointing my son, could stop me. I mean, this sounds like an incredibly stressful and shameful disorder.
Absolutely. And shame is also something that keeps people from seeking help. We, you know, so often a patient will go to their primary care physician, their family doctor, and say, you know, I think my eating's out of control. And the doctor doesn't understand and will say things like, oh, just cut it out. You're too old for this. Or just eat less or go on a diet. And, you know, just horrible advice that, if anything, will make it worse. And so it's hard for them to come forward and explain what they're doing. And that story that you just told, I mean, that just devastates people. And that happens all the time. You know, I had another patient who, she was always in charge at her workplace of, like, cleaning up after parties or meetings or whatever. And often she would find herself being the last person there. And she was just like eating off of other people's plates because the drive to eat was just so strong. And then one of her coworkers stayed late and found her.
Yeah.
And she was just so ashamed of her own behavior. And, you know, that's one of the things that we really have to fight in terms of educating people about what this disorder is, that it isn't just a choice. You know, this is a biologically driven behavior, and it's nothing to be ashamed about. It's something to be treated.
Yeah, sure. I have a question from one of your colleagues, Lotta Borg Skoglund, who says, as a clinical psychiatrist, I meet a lot of children and adults with neurodevelopmental disorders and disordered eating. Specific eating disorders, as well as eating disorder not otherwise specified, is the rule rather than the exception. What would you say distinguishes patients with binge eating problems but few other ADHD traits from those where binge eating is a clear consequence or secondary to the ADHD diagnosis?
Okay, this is a big question.
Yeah,
and we're going to have to go down a couple different paths to answer it.
Go on.
Because there's also another eating disorder in which we're seeing a lot of overlap with neurodevelopmental problems, and that's avoidant restrictive food intake behavior. Now I can't even say avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, or ARFID.
Yeah, that's her next question after this one.
I'll pull them all together.
Yeah, okay, great.
Okay. So, and actually, the interesting thing about ARFID is the psychologists and the psychiatrists are calling it ARFID, but pediatricians tend to call it pediatric feeding disorder.
Okay.
But we're pretty sure we're both talking about the same thing, but just with a different name. And there we see a lot of kids who are sent to us with ARFID who also have autism. But we also see a lot of children with autism spectrum disorder who have ARFID-like traits. We have not yet gotten to the point where we really can pull those two things apart. But that is one of our main research directions now. In fact, we're starting up a big study here on the genetics of ARFID.
Oh, you are? Okay.
A study called ARIAS that will be probably starting within the next couple months.
Is it with Lisa Dinkler?
With Lisa Dinkler,
okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're going to be recruiting children from all over Sweden to participate in this study so that we can address this question. But this is definitely where we're seeing a lot of overlap. Also with anorexia nervosa, there's I would call it a subgroup of people with anorexia nervosa who also have autism spectrum or autistic traits. And Then, of course, with the binge eating, I think we see a couple different things. You know, on one hand, we do see children who have primarily ADHD who have some impulsive eating behaviors. There are also some kids with other illnesses like Prader-Willi, where compulsive eating is part of the symptom picture, and there are also neurodevelopmental traits there. So I think the answer to that question is the most important thing is a very careful diagnostic evaluation that has both the psychology-psychiatry component, but also the pediatric component and the neurodevelopmental component, because we don't have a magic way of separating out what is what.
Det är väldigt mycket information på kort tid när man talar med en sån otroligt smart och medievan person som Cynthia. Som tur är så kan man ju lyssna på avsnitten hur många gånger man vill ifall man missade något. I nästa avsnitt pratar vi om hur ärftliga ätstörningar är, om fördomen om att det bara är tonårstjejer som drabbas av ätstörningar, att diagnostiken utgår från tjejer och att killar därför kanske förbises, om att medelålders personer med ätstörningar har lättare att dölja dem för omgivningen, om kopplingen mellan läkemedelsmissbruk och ätstörningar och lite grann om behandlingar som ju sen kommer att avhandlas ännu mer i avsnitt 4. Innan vi skiljs åt vill jag nämna två snabba saker. Dels har jag skaffat konto på Blue Sky som alternativ till Twitter. Jag heter Christian Dahlström där. Jag upptäckte nyss för övrigt att Twitter har slutat tillåta öppen inkorg, vilket jag hade. Det var smidigt för den som ville exempelvis då skicka DM om tillgång till betalavsnitt om man inte har råd att betala. Blue Sky löser visserligen inte det problemet eftersom de inte verkar ha någon direktmeddelande funktion alls än, men det kommer säkert. Tills vidare får ni väl skriva er mailadress till mig på Twitter eller Blue Sky så kan jag maila avsnitten istället. Det löser vi. Den andra saken jag ville nämna snabbt är att jag nu när jag själv haft en del ångest började fundera på att göra en ny mindfulnessövning. Jag såg också i statistiken att ni fortfarande lyssnar väldigt mycket på de gamla. Så om ni tycker att det vore en bra idé så säg till så vet jag. Då kan jag ordna det. Okej hörni, vi kanske ses i Höganäs eller på YouTube. Men annars får ni ta hand om er tills vi hörs igen. Puss och kram. Hej då.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.